two businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 154 of the Killing It Podcast. Now, if that sounded a little bit different, it's because we have a special guest today, Suzanne Tedrick, who is the infrastructure specialist for Azure for sports for Microsoft. That's a hell of a title. Is joining us today. And she is the author of Women of Color in Tech, which is a spectacular book. And I'm going to put a link to an interview I did with Suzanne over on the SMB Community Podcast. But I promised her we were not going to interview her about that today. We're just going to do the Killing It podcast.
Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So, question of the day. How do you celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
So I will start here and I will say, if you could choose the ideal way, you would get on an airplane, you would fly to Dublin, and you would have a regular Thursday, right? Because that's just normal day over there every day. But if you can't do that one, I found going out to restaurants on St. Patrick's Day is worse than trying to get a reservation at a nice tablecloth restaurant on Valentine's Day. So my plan is I stay home and drink a lot of Guinness.
So I'm not going to lie. That's usually kind of what I do. I'm from New York and I live in New York now, but I used to live in Chicago. And it was awesome to kind of see the river being turned, you know, green and, you know, the parades right. And whatnot. But it is definitely a helter skelter. In Chicago during that time. I remember quite well that my husband and I, we actually did go out to an Irish restaurant that day.
Oh.
And we got into a cab and this incredibly drunk woman was trying to open our cab door and her boyfriend had to like say, no, honey, like this is not our cab. You're not going with us.
So I have a different approach, which is 20 minutes after Valentine's Day, they put out the decorations for St. Patrick's Day. So I go to Rite Aid and Walgreens and the drugstores, and I buy the St. Patrick's Day socks. And to be honest, boxers. There's always in the holiday aisle, you can always find socks and boxers. And so I buy those and make sure that I have, you know, appropriate things to wear for the time before St. Patrick's Day. So.
Yeah, that's excellent. No, and that's the thing. Again, as a fan of food from around the world, I will say, don't wait for St. Patrick's Day to eat corned beef. It's excellent every day.
Oh, I was going to say, just don't eat it ever.
I'm a particular fan.
Are you still relying on a frustrating patchwork of legacy solutions? Modernize your cybersecurity and data protection with Acronis CyberProtect Cloud. It's a single solution that combines backup, anti-malware, and endpoint protection management. As an MSP, you can easily improve client security posture, eliminate complexity, and generate more recurring revenue. Learn more about Acronis CyberProtect Cloud at acronis.com.
All right. So for our first topic today, we're going to look at some unfortunate legal trouble for our friends over at Meta. We're going to link in the show notes to an article from CNET where they're talking about a case that has been brought by the state of Texas to sue Meta over facial recognition. Now, a little bit of background here on this one before we jump in. Just recently, a couple of months ago, Facebook came out and said, you know, that facial recognition thing that we've been doing, we're sorry about that. We're going to stop it. Not only are we going to stop doing it, but we're going to delete the photos and the data of more than a billion records. Now, apparently that was not enough for the folks in Texas, and they've come out to sue for, and if you read the text of the article, a civil penalty in the neighborhood of hundreds of billions of dollars. Now,
amazing.
that's big time. What do you guys think about A, the suit, and B, the facial recognition?
Well, it is two different topics. We've covered many times that the facial recognition has all kinds of problems, especially related to law enforcement and, you know, the discrimination and so forth. This one is really about, I don't know that Facebook could have seen the law coming fast enough, and I'm not a fan of Facebook, but come on, is it fair to say, look, we passed this law really quick and you can't do that, and the company didn't have enough time to remove their stuff?
I can see that, Carl. I do think that it's, there definitely wasn't enough time for them to kind of, you know, make changes and reverse suit. But I do think this is part of a larger pattern at Meta and Facebook of just, you know, monetizing on people's data, people's, you know, likenesses, and I feel like this is part of a larger narrative of kind of curbing what they've already been doing and reining that in, because for a long time, you know, they've been doing this,
right.
And much to the detriment of a lot of people. And so I feel like this is kind of along the day of reckoning that they've been getting for the last couple of months. So I while I can empathize, I don't sympathize.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, you can imagine that there's some lawyer at Facebook that, you know, is there yelling at them, I've been telling you for 10 years, you have to knock this off.
Exactly. You know that philosophy.
He's now been fired, by the way.
Exactly. We don't like naysayers here. You know that philosophy of the Zuckerbergs of move fast and break things. They move fast. And then they broke things, and then and if this were, I don't know, the state of Maine or the state of Idaho, and they were having a dispute here, I think maybe Meta has more lawyers than they do, and they would be fine. This is Texas. And when Texas comes in like this, and Carl, you spend a lot of time paying attention to the regulatory environment, this one seems... What I find fascinating about it is that for the prevailing conversation, what you and I have always had a problem with the facial recognition stuff on discrimination and law enforcement, whatever, those are exactly not the reasons why Texas has a problem with it. They're okay with that stuff. Like, they are over here saying individual property and image rights. And so I fear this one might be a little bit more difficult to defend.
Well, you know, as a nerd, I have always been extraordinarily impressed with, I upload, you know, whatever, 50 pictures to Facebook, and it goes, and it's got all their names right on, like, whatever, 49 of the 50. That's really impressive technology. And they basically, they didn't just like take it down, they destroyed it. And, you know, so I think they clearly recognize this is something where the technology has outpaced, I don't know, morality sense, a little bit of an oversight, but, you know, it's outpaced society's ability to deal with the technology.
Well, yeah. And I think that's what happens with most technology. Like, we're all excited to get the latest and greatest innovation and emerging technology that policy, governance, you know, people's rights, all of those things kind of come after the fact. And now you have to kind of put the genie back in the bottle, if that makes sense. And, you know, right past certain things that probably shouldn't have existed to begin with.
And so one of the things you'll find interesting, right, as I was looking into this, the reason that facial recognition was so dang accurate was that it was not machine learning driven, right? The education of the algorithm was not simply look at pictures and see what you can find, and gradually over time you'll get smarter. It was actually based on you and me and everybody else on Facebook going, I will totally tag my friends in that photo.
Exactly. No, yeah, it started with it learning, like, okay, that's Suzanne, that's Ryan, don't, you know, ding, 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 that's my daughter, that's my cousin, you know.
Right. Yeah. And you think nothing of it, because it's just like, I'm tagging my friends and I'm having a good time, you know. It's like, I want to be able to share these memories with people. But on the, you know, on the other hand, it's like there's this almost kind of nefarious thing going on in the background.
So is there going to be a balance someday where you say, okay, I will in fact consciously, now I'm totally aware of this, there's all the lawsuits, I am consciously giving you access to my data, my friends, whatever, and it's okay, you don't have to pay me for that, because I like the experience I get, right? Can we actually ever get to that, or is that no longer a possibility because of these privacy laws and so forth?
You know, I find that an interesting question. In theory, yes, anybody could come in and say, if I totally tell you exactly what I'm going to do with your stuff, would you do it? Would you give it to me in return? Absolutely, fair bargain. Would I do that with the folks at Meta, given that they went so long and didn't tell us what they were doing? Oh, hell no.
Yeah, so you do it for Apple, but not Meta.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, I think for most people on the surface, the answer would be, well, you know, you're giving me this service and this experience, it's no big deal. But then when you think about, you know, the monstrous amount of money that Meta is making off of you, it's like maybe for some people that's a little harder to swallow. It's funny, during a course that I was taking on media privacy, I ran across this service that will actually pay you for your data. They were just like, you know, we will take all of your data and we will pay you, but we're only going to give you $10 every 3 months.
That's interesting.
And so the company itself is making like
a bazillion. Yeah. Actually, that's not a bad idea. Like, sign here. Like, you can never sue me, right? Because I've paid you. I've actually, you know, and you know, it's at some point, for things like maps and facial recognition, all this stuff to work, we do have to give up a little something. And then somebody else, like, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I get my 2 pennies. I can't complain too much. So anyway, this does remind me, though, that this collection of mass data is so powerful. We do want it. It does bring goodness to our life at some point. So we're still seeking the balance.
Well, and that's the thing. It does have value. They just deleted it all. So you knew they thought something bad was coming down.
That's exactly true. All right. Sadly, we're out of time for that. But topic number two, we've talked about this many, many times, the debate of whether people will ever actually go back to their offices or not. Well, one indicator is, will there be an office to go back to? And, you know, in the middle of the COVID, people sold their offices, sold their houses, moved to other states. Nobody on this show, but, you know, theoretically. But we're going to point to a report from the Harvard Business Review about firms only reducing their office space by about 1%, which is almost shocking given how many stories there have been over the last 2 years. But it's quite telling that there's going to be a different future. And even though you might not have office space for all of your employees, because you don't expect them all to show up at the same time, the company still needs to have a place for at least some employees to show up some of the time. So the fact that you need that real estate is actually kind of an interesting thing that I would have predicted, but most people were saying, no, it's going to completely change the universe. Thoughts?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Carl. I think when you see in popular media, we talk a lot about hybrid work or remote work kind of taking over everything. But I think the narrative that probably doesn't come up a lot is there are many people, for as many people that want to stay home and work and realize efficiencies, there are people that miss, you know, the rhythm of being in the office, the rhythm of, you know, creating relationships in person versus video conferencing software. I actually did read an interesting article in the New York Times that said that the other part of that is that offices basically reinforce hierarchy within the organization. So, you know, when you're in a Zoom call or a team call, you know, there's no like, you know, boss and like everyone's on the same level. Hey,
the bosses don't get the top of the screen.
Right. Like we're all technically equal, but when you're in an office, it's very kind of clear where everybody sits. And I think the narrative that was coming out of that particular story is that they want to kind of A, reinforce hierarchy, but B, also ensure that, you know, we're still realizing efficiencies and innovation, like that we're still operating as close to normal. So I think it's a tricky balancing act.
Yeah, I mean, I think the trick is always going to be to balance the interest of the organization with the interest of the individual. And can you come to a place where those things are compatible, right? Historically, the answer was no. The boss said, come to the office Monday through Friday, 8 till 5. And whether you wanted to or not, whether that was convenient, affordable, anything, you knew that was the bargain and you just came in and did this. Now, the one thing we know for sure is that all or nothing stories are never accurate. We were never going to be all at home forever. And we were also never going to come back all 100% into the office. There was going to be a mix of hybrid. My answer here is consider the source. Many managers have had a difficult time in the last couple of years controlling and enforcing hierarchy over their organizations. And the difficulty means I don't like it. And therefore, I want to drag people back into the office, whether or not they are okay with that. I find this to be, I'll bet you if you got behind the data point that we're highlighting here in this article, it was probably from a study that was funded by the guys who sell and lease commercial offices. Because they're like, they got a vested interest. They don't want to see people stay home. I don't think that 1.5% is accurate, but I also don't think 99% is accurate.
So just so you know, the source is the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. But, you know, I mean, they're seeing that people are not giving up their real estate, right? So in terms of like, that's the reality of it. I will say there's so many variables to this, because with the office, you get culture, you get a social life for you know, younger employees. It's easier to advance your career if you're actually in the office. We've seen all these news stories about this. I think the really good thing about it is we've done a lot of research. Microsoft has done a lot of research about creativity is down, but productivity was up and then it went down. And right, it'll be interesting to see when this is all done, how much do you have to be in the office to keep on the right path with regard to your career, your culture, you know, all those kinds of things. And I think that this really will be pretty much every social PhD for the next 20 years will be on this topic.
I completely agree. I feel like I think from a technical level, we've proven, yes, we can do this work remotely. We can find a lot of workarounds and everything else, but at what cost, you know, in terms of, as you were talking about, Carl, the culture and meeting people and everything else. Like I started my job at Microsoft during the pandemic, and I said to a number of folks that, like, when I remember first going into an office, you know, you go in, you take the tour and everything else, and it's great. And I remember that in my time starting at Microsoft, it was literally me kicking my husband out of the bedroom so that my boss didn't see him on Teams, you know. And it's like, don't get me wrong, I think my colleagues have done a really great job of making me feel welcome and included. But there is definitely a different dynamic when most of my interactions are through, you know, video conferencing and in my bedroom.
Well, and so my daughter also took a new job during the pandemic, and she's never actually met anybody. She's now been there a year. She's never met anybody she works for or with, except on, you know, online. And so it is really interesting. If you think about, like, out of whatever, let's just say 5 days a week in the office, how many days do you have to be in the office to keep the culture going? How many days do you have to be in the office to keep the hierarchy in place, to keep the productivity in place, right? Each of those variables. And, you know, I think that we're finding that it's smaller than we originally thought it was, but it's not zero, right? Culture will disappear if you never actually interact with people in the real world. So I, at least that's what I think, you know, and I now have remote employees. When this all started, they used to sit in the same office with me, and now they don't.
See, and that's where I go, right? It's a question of if going to the office makes people better at their jobs, or if you are creating more connection to culture, go to the office. If it's just for the sake of hovering over somebody's shoulders and micromanaging their task productivity, they don't like it. You don't like it. It's not actually going to improve anything. So don't do that. And you know, if you go through this article that we've linked to from the Harvard Business Review, you know, one of the things they point out is it's that for all the folks that are working from home, how do you take 40% of white collar workers working from home but only 1% reduction. They said, well, it's a reduction of density, not of of space. In other words, I kept the footprint. I just have half as many people there. Hallelujah. Man, I think that's a fantastic idea. If you're going to keep it and you can afford it, if you can cost justify that thing, congratulations. And don't bunk desk people and don't like cram them into little cubbies and make them like feel like drones or whatever. Like, that might actually be a good reason to go back to the office a few days a week.
Well, you know, it's funny. So I worked at HP for a while and they had this big, you know, these offices that are like warehouses, right? With cubicles. And so they always have extra space, and the extra space would always get used for things like indoor soccer and, you know, ping pong tables and all that kind of stuff. So maybe you'll see that in New York. You'll see that at that Times Square office for Microsoft.
Yeah, it'll be a very expensive indoor soccer game.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to talk about a topic that is near and dear to my heart because I talk about it a lot, both in and out of work, and that is NFTs, or as they're called, non-fungible tokens. And so I'm sure that, you know, Carl, Ryan, you've talked about this at length in different
places. At length, yes.
And so if you're familiar with the Gartner hype cycle, it basically talks about the different parts of the technology life cycle for emerging technologies. And so for now, NFTs are classified in what they call the peak of inflated expectations. So there's massive attention, massive hype. Everyone wants to be in on this. It's great. But if you're familiar with the hype cycle, there is three other cycles that, you know, with the immediate one, the trough of disillusionment, where the expectations of NFTs and the reality of NFTs are just so diametrically opposed that people are just like, it's not worth making the investment. And to some extent, I can kind of understand where that's going. But I wanted to talk to you guys to kind of figure out, like, what's your take on NFTs? Like, where do you think that NFTs are going? Are we going to be approaching the trough of disillusionment pretty quickly? Or are we kind of ringing the death knell a little bit too soon?
Well, I think we are. I think that, you know, what's funny is this isn't the same as the GameStop and the Reddit, you know, Wall Street thing, but they're really well related. I think it's the same players that are pushing this, the publicity on both of these. And so I think they're both peaking at this point, but the Wall Street Reddit types are one inch ahead on heading towards disillusionment. And I think NFTs are next. The people who are investing in NFTs instead of paying their rent are going to be very, very disillusioned.
And as folks who have been through the hype cycle a few times with a few emerging technologies, I always have to remind myself that as silly as I think it might be right now, in every emerging technology, in the midst of all that noise and all that hype, there's one or two use cases that a couple of years later, you look back and go, oh, if only we had seen that coming.
Right.
No, you did. It was out there, right? It was like there were 100 use cases, 98 of which were silly, and two of which turned into multi-billion dollar industry platforms. I don't know which ones those are right now, because I'm still very distracted by how many of them are silly. But I have to believe that the slope of enlightenment, when we start coming back out of the dark and we realize, oh, you know, having a digital record that can directly associate purchase and ownership and the chain of custody and everything, there are probably places, especially in industrial applications, where that's awesome. We just have to get through some of the silly season first.
I agree. It's funny. My to your point, Carl, paying, you know, buying NFTs with your rent money. My husband and I were having this conversation because for him and many other people just kind of dismiss NFTs out of hand, you know, because there's silly NFTs that make absolutely no sense. And, you know, people are investing so much money without understanding what an NFT is and whether or not something will appreciate in value. And my attitude has always been, if it means something to you, you know, I'm not going to, as long as your, you know, basics are paid for, like you've, you know, got your rent paid, your utilities are paid, I have no problem with it. It's if you come at it from a standpoint that by buying an NFT, you're going to get rich overnight. Kind of the same way that people thought about, like, if I mine Bitcoin, I'm going to get rich overnight. And it's like, you have to set very realistic expectations when it comes to emerging technologies. Like, it's speculative right now. It's not, you know, it's not like buying a mutual fund or bond. It's a completely different type of investment, and you shouldn't use it for the basic.
Right. Well, and, you know, the next step that's going to happen is, you know, not just stealing, you know, you've seen people stealing Bitcoin, people will steal NFT artwork. And then it becomes so much like real artwork. Like, you really can steal the original Campbell's soup can, right? But ultimately, I think what NFTs will settle down to 5 years from now, 10 years from now, is this will be the ultimate provenance that you actually own this thing, right? That you can track your ownership of something. And it may not be digital artwork inside of a game. It might be, but for the rest of the world who, you know, are not gamers, it might just be that this is the ultimate thing that says, look, we can stop buying proof of ownership for houses when we buy them, because it's just in the blockchain, right? And so once you have it there and it's set, then, you know, you just have to make sure nobody steals it.
See, and Carl, maybe I think you might be onto something right there. If an NFT becomes just ultimately the certificate of ownership of a digital twin environment that represents the physical environment, well, that seems very, very functional. It doesn't seem like an investment vehicle. It doesn't seem like a speculation type of an asset where you're going to get rich on these things, but will they serve a vital purpose? I can totally see that, but I don't know that I'd pay you extra for your house just to also get the digital certificate.
Well, no, but you also wouldn't open a business doing title insurance.
Exactly.
And to your point, it's that it's digital, it's not physical. And just thinking about a lot of the work that I do with sports, I know that a lot of use cases about NFTs are around collectibles. And there's something to be said for that, but there's also something to be said for people that still want that physical, I own it, I can feel it, I can touch it, it's in my house and it's hanging up on a wall. Right. There's something to be said for that as well. And you don't really get that experience with an NFT. So I'm not dismissing it out of hand, but I do feel like, to your points, it's going to take quite some time.
So what would the mainstream use case be? Would it be simply title insurance and provenance? Or is there something else when you think about, you know, your grandmother, what's she going to use an NFT for?
A coaster for the
an electronic coaster.
Exactly, right? When she's in her new metaverse reality. I will tell you, I think that there is, as a rational person, I will always acknowledge that there is a collectibles industry that makes zero sense and generates tremendous wealth, right? I had a good friend when I was growing up who collected baseballs with signatures, right? Would go to spring training down in Arizona, chase around as a little kid and get signatures on there. Now, as a 15-year-old, I looked at those things and I was like, you actually met that human? Holy cow, that's impressive, right? As a 19-year-old, I looked at that and was like, you can't ever take them out and actually throw them? That seems dumb. As a 50-year-old, now I'm looking back on it and going, okay, you tangibilized your nostalgia. That's cool. I think there must be some digital artwork application for collectibles that NFTs can serve. But as a representation of a physical thing, I'd rather have the physical thing.
Well, I still buy the physical thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is, you know, this sort of like collecting those things is like, you can make a wild speculation from 5 years from now, and you make enough of those wild speculations, one will come true. And that's the only one you have to remind people about what a genius you were.
There you go.
I was the one who bet my rent money on an NFT of something that also existed in the real world, and now I'm a billionaire.
So we should sell an NFT of the recording, the original recording of this show.
Exactly. Suzanne's first appearance on the Killing It podcast. And I mean, that's collectible.
Exactly. This will be the ultimate collectible. So
I like your thinking, Carl. I like that.
Again, we often have to say this during the recording. Trademark Carl Polichuk. And
there you go.
Anybody actually monetizes that thing, please buy the
time. So start setting aside your rent money, but that will unfortunately do it for episode 154 of the Killing It. Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.